This is the smell of the leftover tuna fish sandwich you left in your lunchbox over the weekend in a Wimpy trash bag.
Wimpy, Wimpy, Wimpy!
Blech! And this is the smell of that same sandwich in a Hefty Ultra Strong trash bag.
Hefty, Hefty, Hefty!
Ah, smell the difference? Hefty Ultra Strong has Arm & Hammer with continuous odor control, so no matter what's inside your trash, you can stay one step ahead of stinky. And for bigger jobs, try the superior strength of Hefty Large Black Bags.
Welcome to the In Session Film Podcast.
Welcome to our episode 273 bonus content for May 16th, 2018. I'm J.D. Duran.
And I'm Brendan Cassidy.
Thanks for joining us this week, everybody. Brendan, let's settle the debate right now. Is it Laurel or Yanny?
I think we can settle right now and just say it's your Annie. And just simply say that. Why are we debating this, people?
I don't really know either. I honestly don't really have an opinion on it, but similar.
I'll tell you, I have an opinion on it. People have way too much time on their hands. That's what
clearly,
my opinion is.
Clearly, because this isn't even the first time this has happened. I'm sure everyone remembers the gold blue dress debacle of 2015. So
yeah,
here we are a few years later, once again, a dumb thing taking the internet by storm. So
hey, we need something to keep us busy.
Clearly, you know, and I understand it, especially these days. You need something to distract you from the world chaos that is happening around us. And there is definitely a lot of that. So why not debate a little piece of audio that is polarizing the world?
So. Hey, it's their prerogative, man. I'll tell you what, though. If I need a good distraction from anything that's going on in the world, I'm just going to watch a film by Akira Kurosawa.
Absolutely. And while this weekend we'll probably get into some more polarizing topics and debates as we talk about Deadpool 2.
Oh, sure.
When it comes to Kurosawa, a little bit less polarizing in a general sense for sure. And we are going to be continuing our Akira Kurosawa movie series by talking about his 1985 film Ron. It is finally happening, Brendan, after a week and a half of teasing it.
Hey.
We're finally here.
We made a promise, and we're fulfilling that promise. So our listeners can't hate us for that when we made that promise just a few days ago on episode 273. We said we would get to it, and here we are.
And here we are. So we are about to dive into it. And also, the first Kurosawa film in color. That was an interesting experience that I'm sure we'll get into.
A massive time jump, too, because we were talking about a lot of his films from the 1950s, and here we are with a film from 1985 as well.
Yeah, so we are just all over the map when it comes to Kurosawa and this film. But I do look forward to hearing your thoughts, Brendan. So without further ado, let's get into it. You're listening to our episode 273 bonus content. Brendan, my sole desire was to avenge the loss of my family.
Perhaps you've been podcasting a little bit too much, GD.
ご用の策を浪して一文字家を滅ぼしたな。今こそ思い知ったか。女の知恵の浅はかさを。浅はかではありませぬ。親兄弟の恨みのこもったこの城が燃え、一文字家が滅びる様を、わらわこの目で見たかった。
All right, Ron is directed by Akira Kurosawa, and it stars Tatsuya Nakati, Akira Taro, Jinpachi Neizu, Daisuke Ryu, Maiko Harada, and a slew of others. But those are the major players of this film that I'm sure we'll focus on. If you're not familiar with Ron, it takes place in medieval Japan, where an elderly warlord retires, handing over his empire to his three sons. However, he vastly underestimates how the newfound power will corrupt them and cause them to turn on each other, and him.
I was really hoping you weren't going to do the
That's what it says here, so I had to emphasize.
Of course, you would take it way too literally.
Yeah, well, I also want to know how medieval Japan has guns, but that's another debate for another time, I guess. Let's dive further into this. Brendan, what did you think about Ron?
I think we also need to make known that this is an adaptation of William Shakespeare's King Lear. But this wasn't Kurosawa's only foray into the world of Shakespeare's tragedies. Throne of Blood from 1957 was also an adaptation of Macbeth, some even calling that one of the greatest film adaptations of Shakespeare's work of all time. There was also his 1960 film, The Bad Sleep Well, which was very much inspired by Hamlet, although not nearly as direct of an adaptation with that one. And King Lear was actually one of the many Shakespeare plays I read way back in high school, and while I haven't read it since, it was one of my favorites of his at the time because, like Macbeth, I found it very hypnotic and one of Shakespeare's more psychologically complex tragedies. And it is primarily with these reasons why I think Kurosawa's Ron is a masterpiece, not least because it has some of the most stunning action sequences I've seen in such an epic like this, and Kurosawa's direction is something I really want to talk about here. I think Ron is an epic tale of familial betrayal, the quest for nobility, and senility, of a warlord father being betrayed by his sons because his sons feel betrayed by their own father. It is in Lord Hitora Chomonji's own hypocrisy that not only drives him into a mental collapse, but it's what turns his sons against him. And now, at such a fragile age, Hitora wants to imbue his clan with peace and stability, only forgetting how much chaos and carnage he had orchestrated himself to get to the position of power that he was in. And by granting his oldest son, Taro, as the new head of their clan, while still maintaining the title of Great Lord, it's a gluttonous act that reeks of selfish pride and duplicity, and this selfishness is sadly something that never leaves you, and it has already been instilled in the mindset of some of his sons, and I think that is a very fascinating outlook. And it's already a fascinating film from just that point of view, but why I am calling this a masterpiece is because of the film's dueling perspectives. I think each character here has their own psychologically driven reasons for seeking nobility and power, whether it be Taro or the other two sons, Jiro and Saburo. In fact, Saburo is arguably the only reasonable character in this film, and I do want to get to him. And even in the mistress, Lady Kaida, who I actually think is my favorite female character I have seen in a Kurosawa film thus far, they are not simply power hungry. And better yet, I think their actions and choices remain completely consistent with their pre-established archetypes. On top of that, I think the film is something to behold aesthetically. At the time, it was the most expensive Japanese film ever made. I think it's thrilling, frightening, operatic, and sometimes even joyful and funny. I love this film.
All right. Well, I will start off my thoughts by echoing what you're saying about the film's production. Everything about this film is well staged. It looks gorgeous. And, you know, we were teasing in the intro that this is the first time we've seen a Kurosawa film in color. And that is a pretty significant piece of this film aesthetically for me. I mean, every frame of this film is really gorgeous to look at. You can see the $11 million budget. And like you said, that was the highest of any film in 1985. You can see that in vivid ways on the screen. But where you and I will differ a little bit, Brendan, is that everything about this film's drama and its themes especially was incredibly obvious and overly melodramatic for me. And perhaps it's because I'm not familiar with King Lear. I've never seen a stage play of it or even a film version of it, at least that I am, you know, can think of off the top of my head. I've never read any of the source material. So perhaps a lot of this film is meant to come off as satirical or to have purpose with that melodrama. But Ron is a film where the stakes are real. The drama is real. The consequences are real. But many of these characters are not. They are live action cartoons that exist in a world that have real ramifications to the choices that you make. And while there's nothing wrong with the ideas behind these characters, in fact, I think there's a lot of validity in what you have to say about these characters and what they represent thematically. But tonally speaking, the film is constantly at odds with one another. And I did not buy for a second that these characters would exist in the same physical place that has this amount of bloodshed and carnage. And while I criticized Hidden Fortress for its, for the lack of a better term, Jar Jar Binks characters, at least those characters in that film offered some legitimate levity to that film at times, and they did serve some narrative purpose. And outside of those opening scenes, there's not much about Lord Hidetora's arc that I found meaningful in any way. And I didn't really find it compelling, especially because of the obviousness behind it. Lady Keed has some thematic complexities to her that I appreciated, but the film doesn't explore those nuances. And ultimately, she's just rendered as a trite villain in the end. Same thing with the Kiyomi character as well. Those characters, specifically those three that I just mentioned, for me anyway, felt like they came from a completely different kind of film. And they make the comedy of Hidden Fortress seem really great in comparison.
You found comedy in some of these characters?
Yeah, I think the film is being really goofy. And
I think there's only one cartoon character in this film, and that's the character of the Fool, but that's just all I saw.
The Fool is certainly the most obvious, but Lord Hidetora, Lady Keed, they came off as caricatures. They did not feel like real people in any way, shape, or form for me. But I will say, and we can certainly debate that as this conversation goes on, when the film takes itself seriously, and I hate to say this at the risk of sounding pretentious, especially because I love goofy comedies and goofy characters. I love satire. I'm okay with melodrama, but those elements in Ron drastically suffocate the film's dramatic urgency for me. When that dramatic tension is at the forefront, this film is really great, especially given the budget. The huge battle sequence in Act 3 is stunning in its choreography, in its set design, the music and how it amplifies the action, the way Kurosawa uses the camera to capture the carnage. That is really gripping and visceral filmmaking. I mentioned this on Twitter before we started recording, Brendan, that there's one shot near the end of that sequence where Lord Hidetora is coming out of this castle that is on fire. And it's this establishing shot where, you know, we're at a distance. We see the castle on fire, and there's two separate armies symmetrically divided on each side of the frame. And it is arguably the best individual shot of any film we've talked about in our movie series so far.
It is
a breathtaking image. I absolutely loved it. And even the action sequence in Act 5, while not as guttural, I still found it impressive in scale and in the choreography. And I did appreciate what Kurosawa brings to this film in terms of his direction, in terms of that scale. And that is to say, I don't think this film is bad, quote unquote. It has many great qualities to it, especially because of the blistering action and set design and camera work here. The use of color, as I mentioned earlier, is very noticeable and effective, but the tonal imbalances of this film, which are quite prevalent and constant, kept me at a distance with this film dramatically, emotionally, and thematically. This is the first film in our movie series, and I guess take this with a grain of salt because I know this film comes with a massive reputation.
Yeah.
But this is the first film for me that I struggle to recommend beyond the technicalities and the aesthetics of this film.
It's my second favorite film we've talked about in this series so far, so we are way off on this one. I will say that one scene that you bring up in the midst of that action sequence in Act 3, which I think is perhaps the greatest stretch of film that Kurosawa has actually ever done, at least from what we've seen thus far.
It's
but
great.
There are calming moments of patience and tranquility when characters don't speak that I think allows the drama to breathe in those specific moments. Maybe that's why the drama still feels sustained throughout the entire film. It is very melodramatic, but I do think Kurosawa also understands that there is a problem sometimes with too much melodrama. Perhaps you felt it being way too melodramatic, but I did not. I didn't really see these characters as quote-unquote cartoons like you're saying. I actually found it pretty tonally consistent. I think it's a very heightened reality of a real world, and I think it's meant to be very heightened to emphasize some of those themes. And while I do think the themes are perhaps, I know you use the word obvious, and I don't necessarily disagree with that, but I also think there is an ambiguity in what those themes actually mean, because I think if you look at this film from each character's point of view, you get a very different film every time. And that's the reason why I found the film so refreshing and so interesting, because I kept finding myself between that character tug of war, seeing it from Hidetora's point of view. The film is very much about selfish, especially initially, and there's a lot of debate whether he truly regrets the actions of his past or if he's still acting out of pride, or maybe perhaps it's just the results of old age. And I actually really like the performance there too, to be perfectly honest. But I think even from Taro's point of view, it's very much about cowardice and jealousy. From Saburo's point of view, it's very much about honor and discipline. And this is why I just found it so fascinating. And maybe that's why it just kept me so involved, because of that dueling perspective in its themes. Despite the melodrama, it is based on Shakespeare, after all, who is arguably the king of melodrama, especially for his time. I do think there is enough realism in its heightened realism that I was still moved by it.
Yeah, and I do want to reiterate that I'm not familiar with the original source material, speaking of King Lear. And you're right that Shakespeare is very much the king of melodrama, so perhaps there is a lot of intent on Kurosawa's part to keep that melodrama in this film. And you're right that there's a lot of hypocrisy at the center of this film with these characters. It's very much about power. It's about greed. It's about revenge and the severe ramifications that come as a result in men exploiting those traits.
Yeah.
But the film, for me, was a little too transparent and obvious in those notions when coupled with that melodrama that deflates any weight or any power that it has in depicting those ideas. In fact, there's one scene at the very end of this film where there's a character on his knees and he literally spells out everything about this film thematically in his dialogue. And no joke, I literally laughed out loud.
That's the one problem I have with the movie. You've mentioned the one thing I don't like about it.
Yeah, and for me, I think the reason I had that reaction is because throughout the entire experience, that transparency was just a bit overwhelming for me. And I didn't really find much ambiguity in this film with these varying perspectives that you're talking about. I would agree that they're there. I think you can view this film from differing viewpoints and differing perspectives, but so much of that is lost for me because Kurosawa spends so much time in the action set pieces of this film, the melodrama, characters reacting in ways that I just did not find believable. Again, going back to those cartoon characters for me, I think their motives have a lot of merit, and how that ties back to those thematic undercurrents that you're talking about. On paper, I like what the film has to say there, but those performances are just so over the top for me. And that in itself is fine, but then you juxtapose that with the sense of realism within the brutality and the carnage here, and that tonal disparity was very off-putting for me.
Yeah, you mentioned that one scene at the end, which I will agree that that is my biggest problem with the film, because it does not only spell out some of the film's thematic notions, but it does almost create like a singularity in the film's thematic notions. And I had a lot more fun trying to figure out what it all meant from differing points of view. And I think that is very much apparent. I felt that even throughout Acts 1 and 2 of the film, I kept questioning the validity of Lord Hidetora's actions and him choosing to make his eldest son the new leader of their clan, while also still maintaining the title of Great Lord, there's very much a lot of hypocrisy in that. And no, I kept on trying to understand the ramifications of that and whether there is something genuine in his actions. And I think the performances, at least for me, I think do a good job maintaining that ambiguity for me personally. So I personally can't call the performances over the top in that way. I think they are melodramatic. As I said, I did call this film operatic, and I don't mean that as a negative. I like that the film is at times very heightened, and I almost said the word ridiculous, but that makes it sound negative. I don't want to use that, but
it was ridiculous.
I can't call it that. I would just remain by saying operatic, and I really like that about it. But speaking of the performances, I do want to quickly mention one, and that's Miko Harada, who plays Lady Kida. And I know you had some issues with her performance, but there are moments, JD, I actually found her truly frightening and unnerving to watch. And I guess because of those reasons, I was able to maintain that consistency in not only her performance, but even some of the other ones, too. I was genuinely afraid of her in certain scenes.
Lady Kaede is the most frustrating character in this film for me, Brendan.
Oh,
and
man.
I say
you're
that,
disappointing me, man.
I know. And I say that, and maybe I will half bring this around to your side a little bit. I say frustrating because she's by far my favorite character in this film. By far. Because the dramatic and thematic complexities that come along with that character, I find fascinating. This is a character whose family has been killed at the hands of all of these other players around her, and she's forced into this family, the family that killed her family, and she's seeking some sort of revenge. I'll just say that vaguely in case you haven't seen the film.
Right.
And how she manipulates and maneuvers herself among this family, I found really interesting. That in itself, I think, is really great. But why it's frustrating for me is that I do think Harada's performance, while a bit intimidating at times, I agree with you, she does render this menacing quality to the character that wonderfully taps into this revenge that she's seeking. But I do feel like that character gets lost. I feel like a lot of the potential nuances that could have come with this character gets lost in the editing of the film, bouncing between her arc and all of these other players, where you have Taro, you have Lady Hedder Toro, you have Hiro, you have Saburo, who disappears. And because there's all of these characters that we're exploring in separate places dealing with their own things individually, and I just feel like she gets lost in the shuffle. And ultimately, the film turns on her in a way that I found disappointing, because ultimately, in the final acts of the film, she more or less becomes a tri-antagonist. And I didn't feel like it was earned as far as how that character crystallizes, even though it's poignant on paper. And in a way, I do think it comes through because of Kurosawa's direction. But I don't think it has the weight that I think the film is going for, because of how the film, for me anyway, loses itself with the action set pieces and trying to shuffle all of these character arcs into one film. It just did not come through for me. And I found it frustrating because she was by far, not even close, the best character of this film and my favorite character of this film.
I was still able to find the drama in that maybe was missing for you. And perhaps Lady Kaede could have gotten more screen time. And maybe it's a simple solution like that for someone in your case. But there were enough of those individual moments that stayed with me. And I think it goes back to the performance as well. When we're introduced to her, and as we've mentioned, she is the mistress to Taro, the eldest son, who is very much driven by not just cowardice and sometimes jealousy, but that's brought on because of Lady Kaida's influence on him. She, for lack of a better phrase, very much wears the pants in that relationship. And she forces Taro to feel like such a shadow, and that he's only being used as almost like a pawn, and very much so by his own father, too, which definitely leads to a sense of anger, saddening, devastation, as if he's being almost let go from his own family by simply receiving a promotion like this. And I think that there's almost like a sense of puppeteering going on, that even when Lady Kaida's not on screen, I was still able to sense her presence, which is why I didn't have those same problems that you did. Yes, mm-hmm. she probably could have gotten more screen time, but I love the influence that she has on certain characters like Taro, mm-hmm. and then eventually Jiro later on, who is very much driven by mm-hmm. almost this selfish need for strength and mm-hmm. instilling pride in his behavior. I found that very fascinating, how she's able to twist them around by just seeing what drives them most. In fact, she's mm-hmm. probably the smartest character in the entire film because of it.
Yeah, I agree with your ideas on paper, but as I said, I just don't
there,
think...
It's there, man. Come
I
on.
I don't
it's
think
there.
That it is. There's. Okay. I just don't think mathematically there's enough time to justify where that character goes. I will agree, though. I think everything up until about the halfway point of the film, where I'll just say a major character is killed.
Okay.
And the way she reacts to that, I agree with you. It is fascinating to see how she manipulates the situation. But
okay.
after that particular moment, she disappears from the film for a long period of time. Mm. And when we come back, she's asking for someone else to be killed, and then there's some drama that comes along with that, and she doesn't necessarily get her way, so the film depicts her as more or less pouting, and then she disappears again for a long period of time, and the next time we see her, I'll just say her character arc wraps up, and that's it. Mm-hmm. That's the whole back half of the film. We see her maybe twice, three times, and I just don't think that screen time was effective in delivering the kind of nuances that was there in theory with that character. So mm-hmm. I'm half with you. I just don't think the back half of the film does enough to give weight to those ideas that you're talking about, even though I like the ideas. And that's why I use the word frustrating, because
okay.
there was a lot of potential there. It just didn't come to fruition for me. And also another component to it as well, not only does Kurosawa's direction and the screenplay kind of restrain that character progression, but I also think Harada's performance in the back half, that's where it turns from being grounded in a way and being emotional and vulnerable. And like I said, the film kind of antagonizes her, and all of a sudden her performance becomes super melodramatic. It becomes super cartoonish for me. And that just completely threw me off as well. And I could never come back with that character as much as I wanted to.
Yeah, it felt consistent for me personally. I'm sorry that it didn't work for you, because it really did for me. And maybe part of our biggest disparity here is just, at least on my side, there are enough individual moments with these characters, despite their lack of overall screen time, that carried enough weight that I actually found that weight was very much sustained throughout the film. So even a small character like Saburo, who is the youngest brother of the three, or the youngest son of the three, rather, he's hardly in the film, but he has a moment in the first act where he actually has a very well thought out argument that his father's actions for passing on power are going to have severe ramifications, such as how he's sadly banished for it, despite being correct in calling out his father's ignorance. There's an idea that his father asking for peace now at this age, how's that going to go over with neighboring clans? And despite him not being in this movie at all until the final act, then that moment had something that just felt sustained throughout, that I was almost looking forward to seeing this character again. So it's almost like I didn't lose track of him. And I think that's where I think the script does work for me, because there are strength in individual moments that maintain their power throughout the film, even despite their characters not being on screen. That's at least how I felt it. I'm sorry that it didn't work for you, though.
Yeah, it didn't work for me. I do want to speak to the Saburo character, but going back to Lady Katie here for a second, because you're talking about how there are strong individual moments that worked for you. And with that character specifically, I probably could have come around to her if Harada's performance kept that same emotional vulnerability to her that I liked in the first half. If she didn't turn to becoming over the top, at least for me, I probably would have been all right with that character, despite her more or less disappearing from the back half of the film. But when you couple the narrative grievances toward that character with the over-top performance, she just becomes, I hate to use this word, but she just becomes a bit annoying to me by the end.
Oh, man, I want to slap part you. Of the,
sorry, but that's how I feel. And I think part of that is just my frustrations and how Kurosawa treats that character as well. Mm. And just antagonizing that specific character in a way that I don't think was earned in any sort of way. So that to me was problematic. But again, to reiterate, I feel like if Harada's performance would have been consistent, I probably would have been okay with that.
Okay.
Going back to the Saburo character, I agree with you that the first 15 minutes of the film I really like. And that initial conversation where Lord Hidetoro relinquishes his power to his sons and Saburo has that reaction, that is interesting. And then you're right, he disappears for pretty much the entire film until like the last 20 minutes of the movie. But where again we have some disparity, while I appreciate the ideas that you're bringing up with that character, and it's not really the Saburo character on his own as much as what he has to do in those final moments is heavily influenced by the Lord Hidetoro character. And as I've been talking about, that character never felt like a real presence to me in this movie. He felt like a cartoon that is just stumbling his way through this real world setting. And the interactions there at the end felt so false to me and so contrived. So while the Saburo character, I could take it or leave it. He doesn't impact this movie in a way, but his influence in the final 20 minutes doesn't work for me because of how it affects Lord Hidetoro, who, as I said, I think is the most ridiculous character in this film.
I was moved by their interactions in the final 20 minutes, I must say. I wasn't moved in the same way that I was with something like Akira. And I will say, I still think Akira is the best film that we've talked about in this series from a consistent standpoint and even an objective standpoint. But I still found the drama there. And like I said, I think it's really because I feel like the film is about theme. And I think the themes are what connects it all together. I love that moment in the first 15 minutes utilizing the arrows from their bows as a significant way of saying their strength and numbers. It's very much something that went on to inspire the Apes Together Strong moment and Rise of the Planet of the Apes. And I don't know if that was deliberate or not, but you definitely got the same symbolic use of those objects that I found really fascinating. But for some reason, that moment carried through. I kept thinking about that moment, even like two-thirds of the way through the movie when we haven't even seen Saburo again. So I felt like I never lost track of him personally.
Yeah, and like I said, I think his presence in this film is fine. That to me isn't the problem. It's more so how it influences Lord Hidetoro. And clearly we're never going to agree on it because
we aren't. We're being way too polite on this. We don't disagree very often, Jaden. We have to usually take advantage of these opportunities.
Yeah. So I just didn't find anything about it earned dramatically, emotionally, or thematically because of how the film treats Lord Hidetoro. So I never felt any of the connection that's being made between those two characters at the end of the film, even though you're right, the arrows moment that you're talking about, I think is great on its own. I just don't think the film, you know, fully utilizes it effectively at the end.
Yeah, obviously we differ.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, let's go ahead and get to final thoughts. I'll go back to you, Brennan. Any other final thoughts you have on Kurosawa's Ron?
Well, since we are being very polite in all of our disagreements, JD, let's just go back and talk about something that we actually agree on. And our good friend Matt Neglia over at Next Best Picture posted a tweet a couple of days ago asking us to provide what movie image that we would actually like to have as like our own screenshot to hang on our walls. And he actually got a lot of great responses for that. That was before I had finished watching Ron, and I can almost count 20 shots from this movie that I would actually recommend for that exercise, because it really is a stunning looking film. It moves more patiently than some of Kurosawa's other films, especially some of his other adventure films. Even a movie like Seven Samurai, which is, if I'm not mistaken, what, like a full hour longer than this one probably? That one even moves at a much more rapid pace and even a more energetic pace than Ron does. In fact, at times, Ron almost reminded me a bit of like a Terrence Malick film, not just in its color palette, but also the way that it moves. And I did like the patience of it, but I do think Kurosawa does a breathtaking job in just visualizing medieval Japan. Whether there are accuracies or not in the actual history of the utilization of some of their tools, for instance, that we kind of joked about earlier. I don't really care. I really don't care. I think it's a gorgeous looking film, and I think it's well maintained in that visual aesthetic. So I have to give a lot of credit there. There are things about this film visually that I'm just not going to forget. I think it actually adds to the haunting and even operatic quality in the film's drama and its melodrama and its themes, which is why I was able to find the film a lot more consistent than obviously you did. I think there's a lot more themes you could take away from this film than what we're even talking about. I think you can actually look upon this film as about evolving familiar hierarchy of a father figure trying to achieve both compassion and dominance among his family, only to realize that perhaps is not something you can do and they cannot exist together. And perhaps in that sense, Saburo was right. Splitting up power among family does not create coexistence, and sometimes every family needs a leader. And I think that there is some truth to that, too. So the fact that I think this movie is mostly about theme, which is why I was able to come away with it so positively. As I said, of all the films we've talked about in this series so far, Ron might be my second favorite. So take that for what it's worth. For those of you listening, don't hate me by saying that I like it more than Seven Samurai.
Well, I imagine more people are going to be in your camp than mine. This is by far not even close my least favorite film of this series so far. But I will have to echo what you're saying about Kurosawa's direction. And I did talk about this in my opening thoughts as well. But I do think the scale of this film, the choreography and the action set pieces is really stunning. And even when the action isn't ramping up, when it's simply just escalating and building, and we see armies gathering or getting on horses and moving from one place to another, there are a lot of individuals involved in this film. I don't know what the number was as far as extras, especially with the amount of horses in this film as well. But I love how Kurosawa captures all of that. And there's a lot of establishing shots to showcase that there were a lot of people attached to this film that were a part of, you know, building up the realism within those aesthetics and, you know, the armies that are at the center of this film in a lot of ways. And I really loved all of that. It was really impressive to see.
Yeah. Now, if I may speak to that quickly, apparently, just for some facts here, several hundred costumes were created by hand for this film, which took apparently 2 years to complete. And not only that, Kurosawa apparently spent like 10 years storyboarding every shot in this film almost as like a painting, and he almost considered his previous film from 1980, Kagemusha, as the quote-unquote dress rehearsal, which makes me really want to see that film now. That one I have not seen yet, so perhaps we'll actually be able to check out some more Kurosawa films that were in color. But it's really fascinating the amount of time that went into this.
There's a tenacious vigor to Kurosawa's direction and how he paints every frame of this film. And you're right, Brennan. There are many, many individual shots that you could, you know, steal out of this film and put up on a wall. I mean, it's a gorgeous film to look at. And that's what I loved so much about the aesthetics of this film. Not only does it immerse you into medieval Japan in some really great ways, and seeing these armies interact, it feels real. It feels palpable, like you are a part of, you know, this conflict. But beyond that, the way Kurosawa uses the camera here, it not only takes advantage of the amount of people on screen that make up these armies, but he takes advantage of the landscape. So, you know, we get to see them interact with on these Japanese hills and countryside. It's really, really beautiful cinematography, as we've been talking about. The vision for this film is great. Where this film falters for me is in its melodrama and the tonal inconsistencies. And not to bring up the argument once again, but the main thing for me is how not all of these performances, but a few of them, there's a few major players in this film that just feel like cartoon characters for me. They do not belong in a world that has real life bloodshed and carnage that we see. And that to me was just very off-putting. And it was hard for me to buy into those themes as a result. That and the thematic obviousness of it, something about how that transparency interacting with the melodrama and those tonal imbalances just kept me at a distance with this film. I could never really engage with it. I will say, though, there's one bit that did work for me with that humor, and I'll just label this the fox head bit. I thought was actually kind of hilarious.
Like that was
how
great.
How that sequence played out, I thought was really wonderful. That to me is where Harada's performance truly shines for me within that melodrama. Like I thought it worked there, but it faltered more than it succeeded for me. So
that's so sad to hear, man.
Yeah, so we very much disagree on this one. Hopefully we can come around as we finalize this series here in the next week or so. But I will throw up some more thoughts on Letterboxd, and I'll be curious to hear what people have to say. Are they on Team Brendan or Team JD? And I feel like I'm going to be in the minority here. So, you can find us at Letterboxd at letterboxd.com/InSessionFilm.
And we still love you, JD, no matter how wrong you are on this film. So if you agree with me, Brendan Cassidy, on this one, let JD know by leaving a comment on our Facebook page at facebook.com/InSessionFilm. You could tweet us at InSessionFilm or leave us a comment on our Google Plus page or email us directly at InSessionFilm@gmail.com. And I must say, JD, as we round out this conversation, when I was in the middle of my opening thoughts and I mentioned that I thought Ron was a masterpiece and I didn't hear anything coming out of you, I knew we were going to disagree. I just had a hunch that it was coming, but I didn't let it faze me. And unfortunately, it did. So hopefully we can come around and actually find ourselves in sync when we talk about High and Low next week.
Yeah. And as I said earlier, a big part of this could simply be the Shakespeare element, which I'm not familiar with. I don't know how close to the vest Kurosawa was with all of that. I don't know if you're familiar with King Lear at all and how that plays into this at all. But
a little bit since high school, because I read it in high school. I will say from a narrative standpoint, it's fairly familiar. It is definitely an adaptation of it, and that is very much clear. I think you might be right, though, that perhaps seeing Ron with the context that it is at least based on a play by William Shakespeare, I do think helped, because I almost felt like I was witnessing almost an operatic stage play. And I think that's why the film's drama also still works for me. I don't really see it as much of a film. I see it almost like an opera, just without the singing. Yeah. And maybe that's why it worked for me.
And I think I could have came around to that if the film wasn't concerned with its real-life bloodshed and carnage. And that action set piece in Act 3 especially is long. It is a really long set piece that is brutal and brooding and emotional. And you're right, there's a lot of pauses during that sequence to reflect on the carnage that is happening there. I mean, it's about as real as it gets. And there's arrows flying everywhere. Like, I don't even know how they staged all of that and didn't kill anyone in real life. Like, it's crazy, like, how that whole sequence unfolds. And that, to me, just it spearheads the film in a completely different direction. And again, maybe that is part of the King Lear, you know, story element that I'm just not familiar with. But once we get to that part of the film, and the characters that make up these generals and army figures, they take their job very seriously. The samurai act like samurai in this film. And when you juxtapose that with these cartoon characters, that I just...
Every time you say cartoon characters, I just want to fly over the floor and slap you.
I'm sorry. That's what they were. Or just simply speaking, the melodrama. And you admitted that there's melodrama, so...
Yeah, and I liked it about it.
Yeah, but to me, there was a massive tonal imbalance when you go from melodrama, cartoon characters or not, to real world brutality.
Yeah, and I know it feels like we're still reviewing the film, even though we've come to an end.
We're still arguing about
the same
thing.
Yeah, we're still arguing about it. But even in that action set piece that we're talking about in Act 3, it is very visceral in what actually happens, but maybe there's something about the music that still maintains that operatic feel, which is why maybe that's another reason why I was still able to find some tonal consistencies in it, too.
Yeah, so if Kurosawa would have stuck to one or the other... You know, because like I mentioned in my opening thoughts, I'm fine with satire or comedy or cartoonishness. If that's what this film wanted in its melodrama, if it would have stuck to that, fine. I would have been completely with it. And the performance by Tatsuya Nakadai would have been tremendous. It would have been up there with Mifune and Rashomon and, you know, Seven Samurai and the craziness he has in those films. Mm-hmm. I would have liked it, but yeah, the mixture of everything really suffocated that for me. So that said, I guess we'll go ahead and pause there.
Yeah, we're done. We're done.
But like you said, hopefully we cover out as we finish this series here in the next week or so. This has been a fun series, though. It's had its up and downs for me, but I've still enjoyed it nonetheless, and I look forward to seeing more from Kurosawa. So with all of that said, be sure to go and check out episode 273, where Brendan and I don't really disagree at all when it comes to Vertigo and our top three
thank
movie
goodness
moms.
About that one.
So very much in sync on that film. I'll be curious if we do the same this weekend for Deadpool 2 on episode 274. We had some disparity on the first Deadpool.
Yeah.
So we'll see if that trend continues. I'm guessing that the answer to that will be yes. I think I don't think it'll be a Ron kind of discussion, but it wouldn't surprise me if it's perhaps like the first one.
Yeah, so, I mean, we'll see. We both came out positive on the first film, just you were more positive on it than I was.
Yeah. So, and with Deadpool especially, the kind of humor that it's tackling, it's obviously going to be quite subjective, and there are a few gags in particular that are like that are out there. I'll just say they're wild. So I'll be curious to hear if they work for you or not. So,
all right.
Anyway, stay tuned for all of that this weekend. I don't think we've come up with the top three. Well, maybe we'll have something by the time we get to extra film. So,
yeah.
Anyway, thanks for listening, everybody. And we'll see you next time on the In Session Film Podcast.